Welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Norma Walden, chair of the club's International Relations Forum. Our speaker today, Joshua Goldstein, is professor emeritus of international relations at American University in Washington, D.C. He is also a research scholar at the University of Massachusetts. Joshua Goldstein is the author of Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide, just published and available now. He earned his doctorate in political science at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology and his bachelor's degree here in our neighborhood at Stanford. Prior books include The Real Price of War, War and Gender, How Gender Shapes the War System and Vice Versa, Three-Way Street, Strategic Reciprocity in World Politics, and Long Cycles, Prosperity and War in the Modern Age. Please welcome Joshua Goldstein to discuss Winning the War on War.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak at the Commonwealth Club back in my old neighborhood. Peace has been the dream of humanity for thousands of years. But the reality of human history has been recurrent war. And war has been such a central part of our human story that it's easy to think that it's permanent, we'll always have it, and if anything, people think it's getting worse through time. And I'm here to tell you that's not the case. The dream of peace hasn't died, and in the last 60 years, and especially the last 20 years, we've made remarkable progress toward peace. And I don't mean peace, the absolute end of all wars, peace and harmony in the world, but peace as fewer wars, smaller wars, fewer people dying in wars. That's a story that where we've made a tremendous amount of progress. And that's a counterintuitive idea for people because everybody thinks war is getting worse. We see it on the TV all the time. So I want to start out just talking about three generations, my father's generation, mine, and my 17-year-old son. The generations of the World Wars, the Cold War, and the post-Cold War era. We've all lived in wartime, but consider the differences between them. My father's war, World War II, killed more than 5 million people per year. That's a really high rate of war deaths. The Cold War battlegrounds, including Vietnam, my war, my era of generations war, I should say, killed hundreds of thousands per year. And today's wars kill a little bit more than 50,000 per year. So, and I'll talk about where these numbers come from. But in terms of fatalities alone, we're seeing dramatic decline over these generations. And in terms of America's own war fatalities, we also see a dramatic decline. World War II killed about 300,000 Americans in battle. Vietnam about 50,000. Afghanistan and Iraq about 6,000. Now, each life is precious, and one war death is one too many. But in a country of 300 million people, the number of Americans killed in war last year was fewer than the number who died falling out of bed. Afghanistan is costly, it's difficult, but it's not World War II. It's not even Vietnam. And the question we should ask about today's terrible, bloody conflicts is not compared to an ideal world, aren't they terrible, but compared to what? Compared to any time in the past, Vietnam, World War II, the 30 Years' War. And then we'll see progress is being made. And not just the scale of warfare is changing, but also the character of war. During my father's war, World War II, the Americans and British firebombed German and Japanese cities, killing tens of thousands of civilians in a single night and doing this repeatedly, doing it scientifically, deliberately. This was not collateral damage. This was strategy. And, of course, the atrocities that Nazis and Japanese war criminals committed against civilians were far worse than that. During my war, Vietnam, the My Lai massacre killed hundreds of civilians. It was a lot smaller scale. And the atrocities in wars like Bangladesh in 1971 also were very terrible, but smaller scale than World War II. In the Iran-Iraq war, Iraq used chemical weapons against Kurdish civilians, and that was terrible. In my son's time, there are also atrocities in war, and we see suicide bombings and airstrikes. They may kill scores of civilians or even hundreds at a time. And if you're in the middle of one of these atrocities, they're just as atrocious as ever. But the scale of them is getting smaller worldwide as time goes by. And you might have heard the statistic that a century ago, 90% of war deaths were military and only 10% civilian. But today, the ratio is reversed. This is supposed to show that wars are becoming more brutal and harder on civilians than they used to be. I looked into this statistic and found that there's no basis in fact for it. It was a clerical error, somebody mixing up war deaths from 100 years ago with the number of refugees recently, two totally different numbers, and many more refugees are produced in wars than fatalities. And yet, this number has taken hold, you know, as a truth. The truth is that civilian and military deaths are about 50-50. Through the last couple of centuries, the number's not changing much through time, although it does vary a lot from one war to another. Some are harder on civilians, like the war in the Democratic Congo. Some are harder on military, such as the Eritrea-Ethiopia war, which was mostly trench warfare out in the desert. What about the ultimate atrocity, nuclear war? In my father's time, two entire cities with their inhabitants were bombed with nuclear weapons, killing hundreds of thousands of people. In my lifetime, nuclear weapons were never used, thankfully, but tens of thousands of them were poised to destroy the world. This seemed a real possibility, and when I was a kid, we practiced hiding our heads under the desk in school to be ready for when that happened. In my son's time, we're not worried about the world being destroyed with nuclear weapons. We're worried about one nuclear weapon maybe getting in the wrong hands and blowing up a city. That's terrible, and I do worry about that. But it's still progress compared to blowing up the entire world. And more importantly, the arsenal of tens of thousands of weapons on both sides has been reduced by three quarters just in the last 30 years. This is a historic phenomenon, disarming three quarters of the nuclear weapons. And the New START treaty that's just been ratified on both sides is going to reduce these stockpiles further. So this is an important development, although it hasn't gotten much attention. We've also made progress in organizing the world's countries to stop fighting and to control conflict and manage violence. My father was born in the same year as the League of Nations. It was a complete failure. It didn't stop the aggression in the 1930s. It didn't prevent World War II. The United States didn't even belong to it. When I was growing up, the United Nations was young. Of course, it started right here in San Francisco. And everyone belonged to it, and it symbolized humanity. We used to go out when I was a kid with orange boxes to collect money for UNICEF on Halloween. But the Security Council was stalemated by the Cold War standoff and not very effective. Today, the Security Council is much more effective. My son is growing up in a world where the UN has 100,000 peacekeepers deployed around the world, helping fragile societies as they try to emerge from wars, trying to keep ceasefires from breaking down. And the UN has a lot of problems still, but it's also had great successes. By the way, although some American politicians like to bash the UN, and everybody seems to think Americans don't like the UN, when you actually do a public opinion poll, it turns out 79% of Americans want to strengthen the UN. And even if you ask a question, should the U.S. follow the UN's lead, even when it means we don't get our top policy choice all the time, still a majority of Americans agree with that. So it's a strange phenomenon where everybody thinks I support the UN, but none of my other fellow Americans do. There's also now an international criminal court that didn't exist in previous generations, and an emerging doctrine of responsibility to protect, which means that the international community has some responsibility to civilians if their own government doesn't protect them. So from generation to generation, from my father's to mine to my son's, peace is increasing and war is decreasing. America's wars went the opposite direction in the last decade because we had a relatively peaceful 1990s and a relatively warlike past decade. But now that's also reversing. Between now and the end of the year, 50,000 American troops are coming home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we've started the process of withdrawal from Afghanistan that's supposed to end in a few years. As President Obama put it in June, the tide of war is receding. In fact, these trends have created a world today that's very different than in the past. And the biggest difference is that historically, the big wars, the lethal, destructive wars, have been those of national, regular, uniformed armies, one against the other, with their tanks, with their artillery, with their airplanes. Iraq versus Iran, India versus Pakistan. Those are extremely destructive and very lethal wars. And today in the world, nowhere are those national armies fighting each other. Nowhere in the world. This is a remarkable development. All the countries of the world remain armed to the teeth with 20 million soldiers. They all have these heavy weapons, but they're not using them against each other. And notably, China, which people worry about as the next big threat. You know, China is growing. China is modernizing its military. China is building an aircraft carrier. So does that make it inevitable that China will go to war with the United States as it grows? China hasn't fought a single military battle in 25 years. It's the only member of the Security Council at the UN that can say that. 25 years, no fighting. And China is rising on what it self-consciously calls a peaceful rise strategy, that economics and prosperity is what gives the leaders of China their legitimacy, not nationalism and riling up the population for war. They have to deliver on prosperity. And the way to do that is not to go to war. That would be a disaster for China. The way to do that is to have a peaceful world where they can trade, where they can make money from their biggest trading partner, the United States. So when the political scientist John Mearsheimer said last year, quote, to put it bluntly, China cannot rise peacefully, I say, really? Why not? Why would they be so stupid as to risk their own national interest by going to war? It doesn't work. Japan tried this in the 1930s with their coast prosperity sphere. They were going to go out and get natural resources through war, and it didn't work for them. It would work even less well for China. China can trade for resources. China can make money on trade, not on war. So with the interstate wars now not happening, the remaining armed conflicts in the world are civil wars, wars of governments on one side with rebels or insurgents on the other side. Sometimes those rebel or insurgent forces have another government supporting them financially or morally, but never with soldiers from the other country. So you don't have soldiers from one national army fighting against soldiers from another national army on two sides of a civil war. And these civil wars are smaller than the interstate wars. And even then, we have smaller civil wars than in the past and fewer of them. Big wars, such as in South Sudan, Sierra Leone, and Sri Lanka, have ended in the last 10 years, and they haven't been replaced with equally big wars anywhere in the world. The wars that are still going on, really, there are only five of them that rise to the level of daily sustained fighting. Those are in Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, and the Congo. And even these are not big wars like Vietnam and Korea, much less the Napoleonic Wars. And even these are all diminishing and becoming more localized in the fighting, except for the mess in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Of course, what do we all pay attention to? The mess in Afghanistan and Pakistan. That's the problem, and it is a problem. We do need to pay attention to it, but we shouldn't lose sight of the dog that didn't bark. The wars that are not happening, the war in China that's not happening, the war in Sri Lanka that's ended, and indeed whole regions of the world that used to be consumed by war a couple of decades ago and are now completely at peace. Central America, remember the wars in El Salvador, Guatemala, Nicaragua, or Southern Africa, Angola, Mozambique, or the Balkans, whole regions that used to be at war and are now at peace. So the work is not done, but the progress is inspiring nonetheless. Now I want to ask, why don't we believe it? Why is this such a hard concept for people to get their minds around? It's as though we all grew wings, and yet we're walking around on the ground complaining about the extra weight that we're having to carry. I mean, this is a big development. This is big news, and yet people don't believe it. This was brought home from me a couple of years ago while I was working on the book, and I flew home from Stanford to the East Coast and found myself sitting across the aisle from the Stanford professor, Josh Cohen, who had been my professor at MIT years earlier. So he said, what are you working on? And I said, a book about the successes of peace and peacekeeping. And he thought about it and said, ah, I see, a short book. I think there are a couple of reasons why we find this idea hard to believe. One is psychological. We don't want to declare peace in our time and then be proven wrong. And if we expect the worst, we'll never be disappointed. And, of course, the worst is possible because nobody knows if these current trends will continue or whether things will reverse and get worse again in the future. That's not guaranteed at all. So if we expect the worst, we'll be ready for it. And the second reason, and I think the more important one, is that wars are more newsworthy than peace. So wherever wars are happening, war reporters will flock to that place and tell us about the horrors of war. And this is good. This is their job to do that, and we should be aware of it. In fact, I'm deeply grateful to war reporters like Dexter Filkins, who wrote that book, The Forever War, about Afghanistan, about Iraq. They risk life and limb. They go to the place. They're right there in the middle telling us what war is like. And that's much better than sending our soldiers off and not knowing what's happening there, having them come back traumatized, unable to talk to us. So these war reporters are doing a really useful job. But the trouble is, it's a bad way to learn whether war is getting better or worse, or whether there are more or fewer wars in the world, because the war reporter's job is to show us these horrors wherever they're happening. If there's one war left in the world, that's where all the reporters will go to tell us the story. And the story is always just as bad if you're in the middle of that war. If you're in the last war on Earth, it's going to look horrible, horrific. And the blood will be just as red on the television screen, whether it's one war or 100 wars going on. So this is what we social scientists call sample bias. You're only paying attention to one of the things and not the other. It's like if you had a big bowl of red and blue buttons and you were trying to figure out how many of each there were, but you tried to do that by only looking at red buttons. Wouldn't work very well. And similarly, if you try to learn about wars by just looking at the New York Times headlines, you're not going to get a sense of whether they're getting better or worse. I had a student count the number of New York Times headlines on the front page with the word war in them over the last 30 years, this very period that I've been talking about when wars have been declining, but the number of headlines has stayed pretty much constant and even gone up a little bit over those 30 years. When peace researchers count the number of wars and the number of people killed by wars carefully, that's when they find this different pattern, that wars are actually declining. So, if news reports are a bad way to measure the changes in war, what's a better way to do that? And one approach is to count how many wars are going on. That's actually a problem because is the war in Afghanistan and Pakistan one war or two wars or three or four wars? Because you get these complicated civil wars with a lot of different parties fighting in them. And depending how you define that, you're going to have a different number of wars in the world. Also, little wars and big wars really shouldn't be put together. So the better measure, and I'm making a short story out of a long, complicated subject, how to really measure war, the better way is to measure what we call battle deaths, and that's people killed in wars directly by war violence, both civilian and military. That includes suicide bomb victims, airstrike, as well as, you know, people shot and all the other ways that people are killed in wars. It doesn't include the indirect casualties from war, such as when populations are displaced and mortality rates go up, cholera epidemics break out, and so forth. Now, those indirect deaths are also very important, and those people's lives are just as meaningful, and their deaths are as meaningful, but it's a lot harder to measure those. I give the example in the book of the commonly repeated claim that the war in Democratic Congo killed 5.4 million people. It's a very precise number, 5.4 million. And the way they get that number is to compare the mortality rate in Congo with the mortality rate for sub-Saharan Africa as a whole. Well, Congo, before the war ever broke out, was one of the poorest countries in sub-Saharan Africa. It had an elevated mortality rate. It had suffered through a dictatorship for decades, a kleptocracy, as they said, of Mobutu. He stole everything in the country. The infrastructure was decaying. The price of copper had collapsed on world markets. That was their main export. And the mortality rate was going up. Poor people were dying. Then came the war. It made things worse. But did it make things 5.4 million people worse? No, probably 1 or 2 million people. Now, is this important that it was 1 or 2 million people, not 5.4? I think 1 or 2 million is enough to make us concerned about a place and to want to respond and do something about it. The difference between the two numbers is that with 5.4 million, they say the war in Congo is the worst since World War II. And in fact, that's not true. It's just one of the bad wars of our times. If it's the worst since World War II, it seems things are getting worse. You know, wars are getting bigger and more deadly than ever. But in fact, the worst wars since World War II were Vietnam, 1.5 million people killed directly by violence and a lot more indirectly. The Korean War, 1 million people directly killed, and the Chinese Civil War. All of them long ago, all of them early in the Cold War years, not the most recent war being the worst. So, and then the truth of the indirect deaths, those caused by displaced populations and cholera epidemics, is that they usually move in the same direction as direct deaths from violence. Because when an army comes through an area and shoots people or bombs people or whatever, it also displaces populations. And those populations have cholera epidemics and famines and so forth. So the two move together, but the direct, the battle deaths, as we call them, are easier to measure and therefore a better measure of deaths through time, whether wars are getting worse or getting better. And it doesn't mean that those are the only ones that matter, and obviously it's only a part of the total impact of war. In fact, war has many impacts beyond that, terrible impacts on society, but it is a good measure. And we're blessed to have several groups of smart, energetic peace researchers who make it their job to try to measure these battle deaths. The leading group is in Uppsala, Sweden. And if you go up a little narrow staircase in Uppsala, north of Stockholm, and down a little hallway, you find these young, energetic Swedes who are scouring all the available media from around the world and going out to battle zones and trying in every way to compile who's fighting whom. What are all the armed conflicts of the world? How many people are dying in them? So they're putting together data in this way. And they have colleagues in a peace research institute in Oslo who are also involved in this project. Between the two, they have developed the data from which we can look at quantitative estimates of battle deaths. Are they going up or going down? I want to take a moment here to note the small number of resources that we give to this project of counting wars. So if you think of the analogous thing, diseases, epidemics, are they getting better or worse? How many people are dying of a disease and what strategies could we use to manage or control the disease? All the same questions I'm asking about war. You've got the Center for Disease Control in Atlanta with, you know, 23 huge multi-story buildings and many millions of dollars going into that. If you ask the same question about the economy, is it getting better or worse? What's the unemployment rate doing? There are many, many resources going into measuring that and understanding it and figuring out strategies for the economy. But for peace research, measuring wars and war casualties, the biggest peace research center in the world is this PRIO, Peace Research Institute, Oslo. And it's a little brick two-story building with a couple dozen people working in it, not much money. And they have a table next door where they can eat lunch at the cafeteria of the much larger Norwegian Red Cross. So this is where peace research stands today. And my vision, my dream, is that peace research will somehow someday have their own cafeteria, not just the one in the Red Cross next door. So let me talk about the data that they have developed at these peace research institutes. They show... they start in the early 1950s, so after World War II, and obviously World War II would be much higher numbers, so we're already starting after a big episode of war. And they show pretty high fatalities in the early 1950s during the Korean War, and then a lull of a few years, followed by Vietnam, anti-colonial wars, the Iran-Iraq War, the Soviets in Afghanistan. And I mentioned earlier that those were a couple hundred thousand battle deaths per year during those Cold War years. After the Cold War ended, then there's less violence in the world, and the numbers begin to fall. And then since about the last 10 years, they're falling still further, so that we now stand at about a third of the level during the Cold War of battle fatalities. And this has been a sustained period of low battle fatalities worldwide. Now it's still 50,000 some too many. We haven't solved the problem of war, but this is something new historically, to have a sustained lull in war fatalities worldwide. Maybe it'll last, maybe it won't. I'm not saying that, but I am saying this is something unusual and we should pay attention to it. So now I've given you three pieces of hard evidence about the decline of armed conflict. First, wars between regular national armies are nowhere taking place anywhere in the world. That's an important data point, zero. Second of all, that there are whole regions like Central America and the Balkans that used to be almost consumed by war and are now at peace, so that the geographically the regions of the world affected by war are shrinking. And third, that when young, talented peace researchers try to count the number of battle deaths, they produce data that show a sustained and pretty dramatic drop in the number of battle deaths worldwide. Now, the way we think about war, I used to think about war and peace as a kind of an on-off switch. So you're at war or you're at peace. And I tell the story in the book how I got over that idea when I visited Beirut in 1980 during what was supposed to be a lull in the civil war there. Only the lull ended the day that I arrived there. And so there was this fighting going on. And to me, that went, you know, if you're in a war zone, you die. It's absolute. But what I discovered was that for the people in Beirut, if the war is going on the next block over, then you just go about your daily lives. If it comes onto your block, well, then you go inside. So that I started to see that war is not an absolute, it's a relative thing. And that our conception of it shouldn't be that the opposite of war is true peace, peace with harmony, the age of Aquarius, world peace, but rather that the project should be to take war down a scale from raging big wars to small wars to eventually ceasefires. And ceasefires are all important here because the first and most important step, if there is a war going on, is to stop the shooting. In the book, I criticize the idea that if you want peace, work for justice. The trouble with this idea, and I'm all for justice and peace, the trouble with the idea is that it puts ending war at the back of a line of these big intractable social problems, capitalism, inequality, you name it. And so my new bumper sticker is if you want peace, work for peace directly. And if there's a war going on somewhere, the way to get justice and the way to get economic development, the way to get anything that we might want for people in that place is to first stop them shooting each other. That's critical. And since there are no more really large wars going on or wars between countries, the critical thing is to stop these mid-size and civil and smallish civil wars from escalating or going on, and rather to get them to negotiated agreements and then to ceasefires, and then to transitional governments and demobilization and all of that that can follow after the ceasefires. So a ceasefire in a civil war presents a real problem because you're asking one or more parties to disarm, and yet their enemies could take advantage and come and massacre them the moment that they do. So how do you resolve that dilemma? And the answer is to bring in outside help. You bring in peacekeepers, and they can get between the sides and protect the ones that are disarming and keep a ceasefire that has been won from being lost again where war breaks out afterwards. The relevant success rate here is that in the 1990s, 50% of all the ceasefires in the world broke down and wars broke out again. Indeed, sometimes it took dozens of tries before you got a ceasefire that would really stick. Even then, the answer is try ceasefire number 31, and when that breaks down, try number 32. But many attempts, and half of them breaking down and war resuming. In the last 10 years, that number's gone down to a little more than 10% that break down. So we're almost 90% of the ceasefires are holding up. And this shows that we're learning how to use peacekeeping more effectively to come in and keep a war from breaking out again and help a fragile society to emerge from war and get back on its feet again. Let me talk about a couple of explanations for this trend towards declining armed conflict in the world, just to mention some ideas that are put forward as possibly explaining this, and to say that I think that all of them have some validity. Any big change like this has multiple causes, and these are some of them. One is the idea that the norms of peace have changed and strengthened through the centuries. So war used to be cool, Julius Caesar could say, I came, I saw, I conquered, and that was great. That's the way you did it. And now it's not so cool anymore. People say, you know, we didn't want to go to war. We were forced to war. We're defending our country from somebody else that's coming at us. And, you know, our Department of War is renamed the Department of Defense and so forth down the line. War is becoming less acceptable as a solution. And our ideas about it are changing. This may be part of a bigger trend away from barbarism in general. Cannibalism used to be quite common, human sacrifice, torturing people for fun and so forth. And all of these have changed over the centuries. Not completely solved, but changed and reduced. So the trouble with this explanation in my mind is it would predict a gradual diminishment of war over the centuries, kind of smoothly as these norms took hold. But what in fact we saw was ups and downs through the centuries, and then this explosion of violence in the early 20th century in the world wars, and then kicks in a decline of armed conflict, and especially after the Cold War ended. So second explanation that takes care of this problem is nuclear weapons. This is why we saw the decline after the world wars, because the nuclear weapons were invented and it was no longer practical for great powers to go to war with each other. And this may help indeed explain why World War III didn't happen, and that's a big accomplishment, one we maybe don't appreciate enough because it didn't happen. But nuclear weapons didn't stop the superpowers from fighting proxy wars all over the world. And also, since the Cold War ended, as I mentioned, the number of nuclear weapons is falling pretty dramatically, and yet the amount of war in the world is also falling. So that's a little problem. The third theory, which I think also has some merit, is that prosperity makes societies more peaceful. As you become more prosperous, you have more to live for, you're less likely to want to throw it away on war. And this explains what nuclear weapons can't, which is why we have seen the last 20 years such progress, because the last 20 years have been globalization and billions of people coming up out of poverty in places like China and India. The trouble with that theory, though, is that the same thing happened in Europe a century earlier. They became prosperous, and it didn't stop them from the world wars. Indeed, they threw every dime they had into those wars. So that's a little problem. The fourth idea is that democracies don't fight each other, and this is a very good, solid idea and helps to explain why interstate wars have diminished, because more countries are democratic and democracies don't fight each other, therefore fewer wars between countries. Where this one falls short is that authoritarian countries like China are also becoming more peaceful. So, you know, it wasn't democracy that made China not fight a battle in 25 years. The fifth idea, and the one that I really like the best, is that we've learned how to use international organizations effectively during these past 60 and especially past 20 years. We've created something new, the United Nations, and we've learned how to do peacekeeping. This is good as an explanation because it kicks in after the world wars and then it heightens after the Cold War when the Security Council started to function and peacekeeping really came into its own. And in the book, I talk about the history of UN peacekeeping in more detail than I possibly could here. Starting back in 1945, the rubble, the ruins of World War II, and the people who wanted to do something different so that that would never happen again, to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, as the UN Charter puts it. They couldn't be very hopeful at that point about a trend to peace. Instead, they had to create that trend. And everything in the early days of the United Nations and of peacekeeping was a process of invention, creating things that hadn't happened before and innovating and trial and error. One of the big heroes in my story is Ralph Bunche, the remarkable African-American diplomat who really was the inventor of peacekeeper. Here was a poor kid from Detroit who lost his mother, his father moved away, he ended up in Los Angeles. He went to UCLA where his job was to trim the ivy on the ivy-covered walls. And he ended up graduating from UCLA, going on to get a PhD, becoming an expert on post-colonial trusteeship, which is where countries had become independent and the UN was helping them, and then went into the United Nations and was a creator of peacekeeping, first in the Middle East, and particularly in the Suez War in 1956. He worked with Count Bernadotte in 1947 to try to get a solution to the Middle East problem, which we're still working on, the Arab-Israeli problem, and was supposed to be riding in the car next to Bernadotte when he was assassinated by Jewish extremists there. He was also supposed to be flying in the airplane with Doug Hammarskjöld, who was killed in 1961 in a crash in the Congo. So he just happened to keep being not in the place to die, and he went on for many years developing the idea of peacekeeping. The things that we take for granted now, like the blue helmets, it all had to be invented. They wanted a way to distinguish their soldiers in the 1956 war because many of them were from Commonwealth countries, and they wore uniforms that looked like the British uniforms. So the British were fighting in that war. So the UN, to distinguish them, wanted to put on berets, but they couldn't get enough berets. So they got helmet liners, World War II surplus, and they spray-painted them blue, and they put them on. Today we've got, what, blue helmets. My point is that these things didn't just fall from the sky. They were actually innovations that people had to work on, had to create, and figure out along the line. And then from there, we have decades of development and evolution of UN peacekeeping that brings us to the successes that we're having today. Humanitarianism developed side by side with peacekeeping, so that now there are NGOs like Oxfam or Doctors Without Borders, which go into war zones and help civilians. That wasn't true a few decades ago. It all really started in the Biafra War. And the UN has changed its role vis-a-vis civilian populations so that it used to be they would just go in between two armies and ignore the civilians. Now there are mandates to protect civilians. It's still not perfect. Many civilians get hurt, and the UN is ineffective often, but they're doing that better than they have in the past. And also, peacekeeping forces have become more robust, so that it used to be after a ceasefire you could have a spoiler, some armed group that went back to war. This happened famously in Sierra Leone. It wasn't very many people, but they went back to war and were threatening to bring down the entire peace agreement. And at that time, it was the British who sent in some military forces to stiffen up the UN peacekeepers, and they were able to reestablish the ceasefire, put the country back on track. So now when the UN goes in, they may bring some attack helicopters with them, or, you know, be able to wade into battle if need be to protect civilians or stop an entire ceasefire from falling apart. The big refrain in all these missions through the years, though, and it's still a big problem, is that the Security Council gives peacekeepers big mandates, big ambitious plans, and doesn't give them the resources to carry them out. This was dramatically true in Rwanda, where the Black Hawk Down incident had just happened in Somalia, and the great powers didn't really want to be involved in another mission in Africa. They sent a small force into Rwanda, and the Canadian General Romain Dallaire kept telegraphing back to New York, this genocide is going to happen, I need some resources, I need more people, I need paper to file my reports on, boots for the troops to wear. I mean, he didn't have anything. And New York kept saying, oh, no, it'll be okay, don't worry about it. And then as the genocide broke out, he's pleading for more resources, and instead the UN pulled out half of the force. Well, the people who committed the genocide right off the bat killed 10 Belgian peacekeepers, figuring that would make them leave, and it did. Belgians pulled out, half the peacekeeping force pulled out, and the remainder of them did a lot of good and saved some lives, but mostly they had to stand by and watch 500,000 people slaughtered. So today we're trying to solve that problem and give more resources, but it's still tremendously underfunded. And when I say underfunded, the average American household pays $700 every month for our military and veteran benefits, $700 a month. For UN peacekeeping, we pay $2 a month. And peacekeeping does things that the military can't do. I'm not saying it does everything the military does, but it goes places we don't want to go, and it does things that we couldn't even do. $2 a month. My radical proposal is $4 a month. How about, you know, it would make a huge difference to peacekeeping. I think we could afford it with the money that it saves us on our military budget. So there's still a lot of work left to do, and it's a terrible world, don't get me wrong, full of problems that still need solutions. And as long as one war remains anywhere in the world, it's one too many, and we should be concerned about it. Nor can we relax our guard against this trend possibly reversing in the future. There's no guarantee it will continue on. Peace isn't inevitable, and I'm not even thinking that we'll ever get to a complete full cessation of all war everywhere in the world, but we are making dramatic progress. And given the successes of recent years, we have every reason to hope that with continuing effort, we can continue to win the war on war. There's more information on the first chapter of the book at the website, Winning the War on War, and I'll be glad to take questions now. Thanks.
Our recorded audience that we are listening to Professor Joshua Goldstein, Professor Emeritus at the American University and author of Winning the War on War. We're now open to audience questions, and I ask that I hand you the mic so your question can be recorded.
I have maybe a comment. It's kind of a question. I hope you can interpret it as a question. I think prosperity is an excellent point that you made, but also I think the intertwining of economies. It's not just prosperity, but it's you have multinational corporations. China wants the United States to do well, because when the United States does well, China does well, et cetera. The comment I have is I think the great danger is that a few people, a radical group or just people in a room or whatever, can, as the future goes, have so much power. One virus at the Super Bowl, for an example, or you name what the future weapon might be. That's the danger now that we've kind of maybe doing in the right direction of war. We need to start a direction of keeping weapons of mass destruction out of the hands of a radical few.
Yeah, I completely agree with that, and I'm a worrier by nature, so I look into the future and worry about things too, and there's plenty to worry about. The point is that we should take action on those worries and, as you say, keep, you know, nuclear weapons out of the wrong hands and so forth. Sometimes we're slow to actually do that, so the policymakers should stay on the ball and take care of those things. But there's a difference between worrying about the future and knowing for sure that these bad things are going to happen. And I'm saying they might not happen. And in some ways, the odds may be in our favor here, because there are reasons to think that China won't go to war and terrorists won't get nuclear weapons and so forth. So let's not assume that bad things will happen. Let's think about what might happen and then look at what we're doing that works, and do more of that and take appropriate action so that we can continue these hopeful trends.
Yes, just wanted to see what you feel about the rise internationally of the Internet and other very new technologies in this whole area.
Well, thanks. The Internet is... Yeah, my daughter not long ago looked up and said, what did people do before the Internet? You know, it's certainly changing her generation and ours. The Internet, there's two things about it. One is that it's made us more aware of wars around the world, and it actually contributes to our feeling that things are getting worse. Because in the old days, and this is more true the further back in time you go, whole wars could happen or battles, and we wouldn't know about them. We wouldn't hear about them. But now, if a little clash happens, a skirmish, a suicide bomber somewhere, you know, we hear about it right away. It's on the Internet. And so we know about these things, and it's easy to think that the world is going downhill fast because we hear about so much stuff happening, but it's really that we're becoming more efficient about learning about it. But the other part of the Internet is that I think it's making us more empathic and more understanding of people around the world, so that instead of living in our little bubble, we have access to what other people's lives are like. And I think that's a good thing. It's good for mobilizing humanitarian response to victims of war, and potentially good as the Internet spreads for potentially warring parties to come to understand each other and perhaps find better ways to resolve their conflicts.
So you were talking about, you know, the fact that people don't believe that the world is becoming, you know, that there is less war. And I think part of the reason for that is that we are told at all times that we are not safe. We are led to live a life of fear. I mean, the events of September 11th have completely destroyed our civil liberties, our sense of well-being. And, you know, we may be fighting fewer wars, but we are spending more on war than ever. It is taking away our liberties. It is taking, you know, it is what it's doing for, you know, the social safety net in this country. I mean, I think part of the reason that we feel like war is all invasive is that it is. It is the, you know, this idea that we are not safe and that we need to depend on, you know, these huge multinational corporations to protect us, when really I think they're robbing us blind, is one of the reasons that we don't, that people feel like we're at war. Because I think we're at war to save our country from these companies that are telling us that they're doing this for our own good.
Yeah, well, fear is a big issue. It's a big factor. And if everybody would read my book and put it in perspective, then I guess we wouldn't be so afraid. Maybe we wouldn't have to be spending more than we did during the Cold War on military spending. But I think there's also a big issue here in our society where we're losing a sense of scale. Now I'm kind of diverging just from war, but it's hard to have a sense of scale when we're exposed to so much information all the time. And as I say, one war or 100 wars all looks the same on the TV screen. So it's good to have the direct, you know, reporting from the scene of a war, but I think we also need people like professors of international relations to put it in perspective and say, you know, like the satellite's going to fall out of the sky. And so you can say, well, you know, the chances of that satellite hitting me are 1 in 100 million or something. I probably would be well advised to go about my day. But if you turn on the TV, it's going to be, you know, satellite. Could it hit your neighborhood? Well, yeah, it could, but it's not likely to. So a way to have a more reasoned discourse about the threats to our country, there are some. The risks of terrible events in the future, there are some. The costs to address those, maybe we're spending more than we should on military adventures and maybe less than we should on peacekeeping and so forth. So I'm trying to have a more reasoned discourse, which is not always the easiest thing to do in this climate, but it's a good thing.
It's my understanding we have about a military presence in about 120 countries, and I think it's even higher than that. And even thoughtful people now are beginning to wonder, why do we need to be in Germany? Why do we have to be paying to protect North and South Korea? And there's a real movement, it seems like, that we should simply get out and cut it down enormously. Could you explore what would happen if we were to do that?
Well, this is not hypothetical, because funny things happened during this last decade while we sent so many troops over to Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's where we all focus, rightly. During that period, we have pulled back tens of thousands of troops from Germany, Japan, South Korea, Latin America, so that as we come home from Iraq and Afghanistan, and we are coming home pretty rapidly now, we will find a lighter American footprint around the world than we've had for decades, maybe since the 1930s. We don't need big bases in Germany prepared for the Soviet army to come across, you know, the gap there with their tank formations. I mean, this is, it's taken us some time to realize that we don't need that. And in general, we're spending a lot of money on big, heavy formations ready to fight other countries which are probably not likely to attack us. So, in fact, we are bringing home troops from Japan, Korea, Germany. And the effect probably varies from place to place. There are some concerns about pulling out too fast in a place like Japan or South Korea, where there are some conflicts in the neighborhood. The Taiwan-China conflict is one I still worry about. I don't think it's going to lead to war, but it's kind of unstable. So you don't want to pull out too fast and create power vacuums, and I sympathize with that somewhat. Germany, I don't think we really need to be there in as great strength as we are. And in fact, we are pulling back pretty dramatically. So, you know, we have gone overseas to Iraq, Afghanistan in a big way, and that's now winding down. What we haven't noticed is that some of these military commitments elsewhere in the world are also winding down. I don't think the number of countries where the U.S. has troops stationed is a very good indicator, because some of these are very small, you know, the anti-terrorism missions, the training missions, and so forth. But the big bases with the tens of thousands of troops, we don't need as many of them anymore, and in fact, we're pulling them back.
I was born in February 1946, and consequently I just retired. And as I look back at my lifetime, the two things that amazed me most, one was the Berlin Wall coming down, and the second, even more so, there hasn't been one nuclear bomb exploded in anger, because I missed, of course, the first three. And so I'm very amazed at that. I still am amazed about that. And I also had those duck and cover exercises back in elementary school, and thus my interest in your topic. The second thing that kind of came to my mind is someone mentioned mercenaries, and so I've been reading Al Vintner's book on mercenaries in Africa, and very, very different perspective. Actually, they are an efficient way to reduce wars. And a quotation he makes, which I'd like you to comment on, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan in 1998 at the Ditchley Foundation lecture said, when we had need of skilled soldiers to separate fighters from refugees in the Rwanda camps in Goma, I even considered the possibility of engaging a private firm. I did not do so because I believed that the world might not be ready to privatize peace, which is to say professional soldiers, mercenaries, but it is an efficient way.
Well, it's a complicated topic, mercenaries or private security firms, and I think there's a lot of difference from one to the other and from one war to the other. So their role in support of U.S. forces in Iraq, I'm not so keen on. Their role in the war in Sierra Leone was actually pretty positive. The government there brought in some outside westernized kind of security forces, and they were actually more respectful of human rights than either the government or the rebel forces. And they also stopped the rebels from storming the capital and overthrowing the government and launching a whole new round of war on at least one occasion. So I'm not going to say they're all bad, but we would want to look carefully case by case. I'd like to talk about your first comment about the life you've led since 1946. And I mentioned this at the end of the book. My grandmother was born in the 1890s, and she lived through such an amazing period of time. She lived to 101 years old, and she saw the invention of the automobile and, you know, the airplane. Computers were just magic in her eyes. And late in this life, I sat down with her, and she told me, "My greatest fear is that I've lived through two world wars, and I'm afraid of a third one." That was the single greatest fear in this life of 101 years. And it didn't happen. You know, people talk rhetorically about the Cold War was World War III and the war with Islamofascism is World War IV or something. My grandmother knew the difference. Those are not world wars. What she saw was the real thing. And we are blessed to have not experienced that in our lifetime.
I'm interested in your figures. I read a quote from Tommy Franks, I think about 2004, that the U.S. Military does not take body counts, which is interesting because when you see the all the military medals, they always say defeated 65 enemy insurgents, blah blah blah. But so this Swedish group that you've been dealing with, what's the primary data source if the actual people pulling the trigger, so to speak, in some of these conflicts that you're mentioning aren't counting?
Right. Well, usually there's some. First of all, it's tremendously difficult to do body counts in war. And the U.S. military got in trouble with it in Vietnam by inflating these body counts. It became kind of notorious. And so now in Iraq and Afghanistan, we don't count bodies. There's a project called Iraq Body Count, which in fact scours the newspapers, local, all the local media, and tries to get reports of three people were killed in this incident and 20 people were killed by this airstrike, and then putting together totals. Now, that's a conservative total because there are people who die and are not reported that way. And that's basically what the Swedes are doing with other wars in the world. But they also will go to the scene, talk with people, try to figure out what really happened, what did happen in this battle, were people killed. The other trouble with body counts to try to assess whether wars are getting better or worse is that there's a chronological bias. The further back in time you go, the less likely you are to get a complete count. So we might have a pretty good idea how many battle deaths there were this year, but 20 years ago, stuff happened that never got into the newspapers. It was before the internet, for instance. And 200 years ago, whole wars, you know, big bloodletting wars in China might happen and never get reported into the European-centric kind of databases of war. So when we see in the data that the numbers are declining, the actually decline must be bigger than what we're seeing, because as you go back in time, there were probably more deaths than are being reported.
As you are a student of war and peace, and certainly currently in the headlines, what are your thoughts about the Middle East Arab-Palestinian situation?
Well, the Arab-Israeli conflict is the longest running of the world's major armed conflicts. It's not the most deadly because it goes along, you know, at a relatively low levels of violence. It's the longest running, and it's especially important one because it has a great symbolic importance even to people who are unaffected by it directly. Mostly the Arab world is very attuned to the Palestinian issue. So I think we need to redouble our efforts to get a solution to that problem. Now, we have made a lot of progress over the years, which we sometimes forget. Egypt and Israel are at peace. Israel and Jordan are at peace, formally at peace. We have this remaining issue, real unresolved core of the issue about the two-state solution and the Palestinian state and what it's going to look like. Now, even there, the two sides have come pretty close to agreeing what the borders will be, how the refugee problem will be handled, how Jerusalem will be handled. But they just haven't quite gotten that last step there. I believe that the United Nations is a good place to talk about that problem, and that by bringing it to the UN, we could create the overall framework in a Security Council resolution of what a two-state solution should look like. And this would really deflate some of the extremists on each side who want it all for themselves. So a two-state solution should have an Israeli, a Jewish state with all its citizens, and a Palestinian state with all its citizens living side by side in peace. It should be based on the 1967 borders with mutually agreed land swaps that take into account some population shifts. And it should have the capital of Israel in Jerusalem, the capital of Palestine in East Jerusalem. And all of this is pretty well known, that this is what the solution will look like. But I believe that the United Nations uniquely could put legitimacy onto this solution and give a push to negotiations to really carry it out and work out the last details. If we could solve that problem, being the longest standing of these conflicts and the one that has outsized significance throughout the world, it would be not only a tremendous boost to my book sales, but, I mean, this would really do the world a world of good, because from there we'd get a hopeful feeling that intractable disputes can be solved and that no war lasts forever. And we could go on from there, I think, and solve some of the other places like Somalia that are just heartbreaking and have gone on for decades, which also would need our attention. But I think everybody to focus on Palestine and Israel is a good thing, and to bring it to the UN is a good thing. They're there in the United Nations General Assembly today all talking about it, and President Obama was there talking about it. I think, you know, the General Assembly can be a bit of a circus at times, and it's talk, 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 but it's a good thing. All the leaders of the world coming together in this big room, and everybody gets their say, the crazy tin pot dictators and the serious leaders of big important countries all talk it out together. So I was thrilled to see our president there and all the other leaders, one after the other, trying to resolve these problems. The UN is the best tool we have in the world for solving our big international problems. It's one that the United States created. It's one that we host. It's one that we can veto anything we don't like, which is pretty handy. And I think Americans should really make use of this tool and make more of it than we have.
We have time for one more question. I see a hand up here, so here comes the microphone.
The United States could resolve that issue at the drop of a hat. There is so much money being made maintaining that conflict. I don't think they want it to stop.
Well, I don't agree with that.
I think it's for me, war is a money game. It always has been a money game. And if you take money out of the equation, I think you would have not near the number of wars that you have, especially in the United States, in that a major contribution to our economy is based on the military-industrial complex.
Well, There's, of course, some truth to that. Some companies do make a lot of money from wars. For instance, Halliburton's share value doubled during the Iraq War. They made a lot of money on that war. But other companies lose money in war. For instance, the Iraq War drove the price of oil up, and remember that we had airlines and car companies going into bankruptcy as a result. The oil companies made more money because the price of oil was high. The manufacturing companies lost their shirts because the price of oil was high. So I think that it's simplistic to just say war fuels corporate profits, and that's why we have it. Overall, war does more harm to the economy than good, and this has been true for a long time. Maybe it wasn't true back when you could conquer territory and grow more food on it or something, but in today's kind of world, war does a lot more harm than good, but there are players who can make money on war, and of course they'll be in lobbying for what's good for them. But so will the other ones be in lobbying that peace is good for them. So I don't think we can end it on a drop of a hat, even if it were just economic, and I don't think it's all economic. If the United States could solve the Arab-Israeli problem, it would be good for the world economy. It would be good for international trade, and it would be good for the political fortunes of whoever happened to be lucky enough to be U.S. president when it happened.
Our thanks to Professor Joshua Goldstein, Professor Emeritus of International Relations at the American University and author of Winning the War on War, The Decline of Armed Conflict Worldwide. He gave a well-organized and basically hopeful talk. So thank you.
Thank you.